Chapter 4. Ignoring the Canary. When Janice and Isaiah Tomlin married in 1977, they promised each other that by their first anniversary, they'd become the first people in their families to own their own home. Janice's mother had always dreamed of owning a house, but segregation limited the options for Black people in Wilmington, North Carolina. So on the salaries of an elementary school teacher and an auto mechanic, the Tomlins saved up about $1,000 for a down payment and bought a two-bedroom, bright blue house on Creasy Avenue for $11,500. They moved in right before their anniversary. All the houses on Creasy have inviting front porches, and that's where Janice was sitting when I met her and Isaiah in the summer of 2020. A consumer attorney I've known for nearly two decades, Mike Calhoun, introduced me to them and connected us by a video call on their porch instead of the trip I'd planned to take to visit them due to the pandemic. Janice told me about her introduction to the neighborhood. One night before they moved in, she was in the house, painting over the dreadful lime green the previous owners had chosen for all the rooms when she needed to make a call. The Tomlins' phone wasn't hooked up yet, but a nice white lady who lived next door offered to let her come in and use hers to call Isaiah. And I thought, gee, this is so nice. This is so kind, she recalled. Her soon-to-be neighbor was out on the porch when Isaiah arrived later that night. Tall and deep mahogany-skinned, Isaiah was decidedly not what the white neighbor was expecting to see. Janice is fair-skinned and had just pressed her hair straight.
Oh, if you could have seen her face, Janice whistled as Isaiah laughed at the memory.
I will tell you that she was gone within months, never spoke to us again, and was gone within months. And I thought, oh, did we do that? She nodded to herself. We did. More Black families moved in, and by the late 1990s, Janice said, it was a Black neighborhood. Janice and Isaiah were raising two children and kept improving their dream house. As the equity grew and the neighborhood changed, the phone calls started coming in from people marketing refinance loans. It just so happened that Janice was determined to send her children to parochial school, and like many parents, she looked to their nest egg to help finance the tuition. In the early spring of 1998, a company called Chase Mortgage Brokers had called the Tomlins multiple times, so Janice made an appointment to go in. The very first meeting, the lady was so, I look back now, exceptionally kind, just overbearing with kindness and patience, Janice recalled. And I'm a question person. I ask a lot of questions. And she sat and she listened to me. For all Janice's questions, however, there were some answers she wouldn't get from Chase, not until they showed up as evidence in a class action predatory lending lawsuit. It turns out that Chase held itself out as a broker, someone a borrower hires to find them the best loan and who has a fiduciary duty to the borrower under North Carolina law. But Chase had a secret arrangement with just one lending company, Emergent. The exceptionally kind salesperson received kickbacks for every Emergent loan she sold, and no matter how low an interest rate a borrower might have qualified for, if the salesperson could sell them a higher price loan, she received even more of a kickback. The salesperson at Chase also hid from Janice the extent of the high cost fees that would be taken out of the Tomlins' home equity at signing. The included costs amounted to 12% of the loan on day one. Unbeknownst to them, the Tomlins had refinanced their dream home with a subprime mortgage with an annual interest rate in the double digits, unrelated to their credit scores. This last point was important because the official justification for the exorbitant cost of subprime mortgages was that the higher costs were necessary for lenders to price for the risk of defaults by borrowers with poor credit. But lenders have no duty to sell you the best rate you qualify for. The limit is whatever they can get away with. I asked Janice, had you ever been late on your payments or missed a mortgage payment?
Her warm voice turned firm. Never. Never, I repeated. That was very important to you? Very important. Never late, she said, shaking her head emphatically. Subprime would become a household word during the global financial crisis of 2008. I first came across the term when I started working at Demos in 2002 and when, as part of my outreach about our consumer debt research, I went to community meetings with dozens of borrowers just like the Tomlins, disproportionately Black homeowners who were the first to be targeted by mortgage brokers and lenders. The loans are called subprime because they're designed to be sold to borrowers who have lower than prime credit scores. That's the idea, but it wasn't the practice. An analysis conducted for the Wall Street Journal in 2007 showed that the majority of subprime loans were going to people who could have qualified for less expensive prime loans. So, if the loans weren't defined by the borrower's credit scores, what did subprime loans all have in common? They had higher interest rates and fees, meaning they were more profitable for the lender. And because we're talking about 5- and 6-figure mortgage debt, those higher rates meant massively higher debt burdens for the borrower. If you sell someone a prime rate, 5% annual percentage rate, or APR, 30-year mortgage in the amount of $200,000, they'll pay you back an additional $186,512, 93% of what they borrowed, for the privilege of spreading payments out over 30 years. If you can manage to sell that same person a subprime loan with a 9% interest rate, you can collect $379,328 on top of the $200,000 repayment, nearly twice over what they borrowed. The public policy justification for allowing subprime loans was that they made the American dream of homeownership possible for people who did not meet the credit standards to get a cheaper prime mortgage. But the subprime loans we started to see in the early 2000s were primarily marketed to existing homeowners, not people looking to buy. And they usually left the borrower worse off than before the loan. Instead of getting striving people into homeownership, the loans often wound up pushing existing homeowners out. The refinance loan stripped homeowners of equity they had built up over years of mortgage payments. That's why these diseased loans were tested first on the segment of Americans least respected by the financial sector and least protected by lawmakers, Black and brown families. In the latter half of the 1990s, the share of mortgages that were subprime nearly doubled. By 2000, half of the refinance loans issued in majority Black neighborhoods were subprime. Between 2004 and 2008, Black and Latinx homeowners with good credit scores were 3 times as likely as whites with similar credit to have higher rate mortgages. A 2014 review of the pre-crash mortgage market in 7 metropolitan areas, found that when controlling for credit score, loan-to-value, debt-to-income ratios, and other risk factors, Black and Latinx homeowners were 103% and 78%, respectively, more likely to receive high-cost mortgages. At the closing, Janice saw that her interest rate was high, but the sales rep reassured her. She told me that I could come back in and we could lower the interest rate once I had paid on it for a certain amount of time. It was like a perk for me. The interest rate will be lower. So I thought, well, this is good. It sounds like she's doing everything on my behalf. Then there was the God part. Janice's sweet voice grew an edge as she said, she had figured me out. Janice had told the broker that they were looking to refinance in order to free up money to pay for their children's Christian schooling. And so she talked about her Christian faith, which resonated with me. I remember the crosses that she had in the office. The sales rep had touched Janice's hand and told her, I know that God must have sent you to us. We're here for you. Janice shook her head at the memory of this person who was talking about God and is trying to show me that she's given me probably the best deal that I can get. I wasn't taught to doubt people who presented themselves as God-fearing people, so I didn't doubt. She and Isaiah signed the paperwork. Soon after, the address the Tomlins sent their monthly payments to began to change frequently. The loans were being repeatedly sold, but Janice says, we were just trucking along and making the payments. It wasn't until Isaiah had a chance encounter with a local attorney that the Tomlins learned just how predatory their refinance loan was. That lawyer, Mallard "Mal" Maynard, was helping Isaiah recover a stolen tractor when Isaiah mentioned his refinance loan. Unlike his wife, Isaiah had never had a good feeling about the salesperson or Chase. Maynard asked if they still had the paperwork, and Janice did. Of course I do, she told her husband. I'm a school teacher. I keep papers. Mal Maynard had joined our conversation on the porch. I got copies of his paperwork, and it just blew me away, he told me.
What blew you away about it, Mal? I asked. It wasn't the monthly payment, right? Because it sounds like the monthly payment was reasonable.
It was the equity stripping. It was the yield spread premiums. It was the origination fee. It was the duplicative fees. They had lots of duplicative fees with words that really made no sense as to what they were for. Chase had even charged the Tomlins a discount fee, which is what a borrower might pay a broker to get a lower rate than they qualify for, which was absurd given that the Tomlins' rate was higher than they qualified for. But Mal, they weren't the only ones, right?
Oh, no. That was just the tip of the iceberg when I ran into Janice and Isaiah. Started looking at the registered deeds office and tracking down dozens and then hundreds of other similar loans, Maynard said. He pointed to Janice. She's being modest. She was the lead plaintiff for 1,300 folks whose homes she helped save, who had gone through the same thing.
Overcoming their shame to be named plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit wasn't easy for Janice and Isaiah. In the courtroom, there'd be someone to make a mockery of my ignorance. That was really hard to swallow, Janice admitted. But I knew that, in the end, there would be others who would benefit from it. As I listened to their story, my mind kept wandering back to what I'd seen early in my career and to the millions of families who weren't so lucky. The way the Tomlins story began, an American dream deferred by segregation, white flight, a black neighborhood targeted by unscrupulous lenders, and the steering of responsible black homeowners into equity-stripping predatory mortgages could have been cut and pasted from a report of hundreds of black middle-class neighborhoods across the country in that era. In the early 2000s, the economy had recovered quickly from the tech bubble and 9/11-related recession. Housing prices seemed to know no limit, and financial sector profits were soaring. At Demos, when we did our first visit to Congress with copies of our research report on debt called Borrowing to Make Ends Meet, a Democratic Senate staffer told us point blank not to bother, that the banks, quote, owned the place. We were laughed out of the offices of Republican members of Congress with our passé talk about regulation. The consensus to loosen the rules on Wall Street investment houses and consumer banks had become bipartisan during the Clinton administration, and the proof, it seemed, was in the profits. But through my job, I had a front row seat to what was really driving it all, a tragedy playing out in black and brown communities that would later take center stage in the global economy. I'll never forget a trip I took to the Mount Pleasant neighborhood in Cleveland, Ohio. On a leafy street, residents told me how, a few years back, house by house, each homeowner, over 90% of them black, with a few Latinx and South Asian immigrants, had opened an envelope, answered a knock on the door, or taken a call from someone with an offer to help consolidate their debt or lower their bills. In the ensuing years, with quiet shame and in loud public hearings, with supportive aldermen, pastors, and lawyers outmatched by the indifference of bankers and regulators with the power to help them, residents had fought to keep their homes. But by 2007, the block I was on had only two or three houses still in the hands of their rightful owners.
I excused myself from the group and walked around the corner, barely getting out of their eyesight in time to fall to my knees, chest heaving. It was the weight of the history, the scale of the theft, and how powerless we had proven to change any of it. These were properties that meant everything to people whose ancestors, grandparents in some cases, had been sold as property. To this day, it's hard for me to think about it without emotion. That's why, as I looked at the Tomlins smiling at each other on their porch more than a decade later, it was like I'd slipped into the world as it could have been, as it should have been. With the relative rarity of a lightning strike, an available and dogged lawyer, a well-timed suit in a state with good consumer protections, and a particularly corrupt and inept defendant, the Tomlins had saved their home and protected more than 1,000 other working and middle-class homeowners in their state. Had more Black families targeted by subprime lenders in those early years found the Tomlins' happy ending, history would have turned. The mortgage market would have learned its lesson about subprime mortgages earlier in the 2000s, and the worst excesses would have been checked before they spun out of control and toppled the entire economy, causing $19.2 trillion in lost household wealth and 8 million lost jobs, and that was just in the United States. The earliest predatory mortgage lending victims, disproportionately Black, were the canaries in the coal mine, but their warning went unheeded. Before the coronavirus-driven downturn of 2020, the financial crisis of 2008, and the ensuing Great Recession was widely considered to be the single most traumatic event in the financial life of the nation since the Great Depression. Less commonly known is that we're beginning to understand how the tail effects may even eclipse those of the Depression in terms of lost wealth. In 2017, the country had 400,000 fewer homeowners than in 2006, although the population had grown by some 8 million households since then. Homeownership rates reversed their historic pattern of steady increases, shrinking from 69% in 2004 to less than 64% in 2017. More than a decade after the crash, the typical family in their prime years has still not recovered the level of wealth held by people the same age in previous generations. Families headed by millennials, who entered adulthood during the Great Recession, still have 34% less wealth than previous generations. They will likely never catch up. The blast radius of foreclosures from the explosion on Wall Street was far-reaching and permanent. By means of comparison, in 2001, about 183,000 home foreclosures were reported across the nation. By 2008, a record 983,000. In 2010, a new record, more than 1,178,000. An accounting on the 10th anniversary of the crash showed 5.6 million foreclosed homes during the Great Recession. Although homeowners of color were represented out of proportion to their numbers in society, the majority of these foreclosed homes belonged to white people. From lost homes, the losses cascaded out. Nearby houses lost value. Some 95 million households near foreclosed homes lost an estimated $2.2 trillion in property value. Local communities brought in less tax revenue, which led to widely felt cuts in school funding, vital services, and public jobs. It was a contagion, and not just metaphorically. Even the dispossessed homes themselves spread sickness, as demolitions of vacant houses sent decades dormant lead toxins as far as the wind would carry them. In Detroit, a surge in childhood lead poisoning would mark the decade after the recession. One study identified home foreclosures as the likely cause of a sharp rise in suicides during 2005 to 2010, while another found that the Great Recession triggered declining fertility and self-rated health and increasing morbidity, psychological distress, and suicide in the United States. In 2017, an examination of all third through eighth graders in the United States revealed significantly reduced student achievement in math and English language arts linked to the Great Recession.
Between December 2007 and early 2010, 8.7 million jobs were destroyed. Amy Rogers is a white woman whose life has been forever changed because of the Great Recession. In 2001, she and her husband bought their first home, a three-bedroom house she describes as funky and long on character. She had her own savings and the money her late parents had left her, $50,000, to put into the purchase to keep their mortgage payments modest. By 2005, Amy had a great job for the first time in her life, one with a good salary and benefits, working for her county government. Then she discovered that without her knowledge, her husband had pulled all the equity out of the house and used it for his own purposes. Shocked, she began divorce proceedings. In 2007, the divorce became final and Amy got the house refinanced in her own name. But she had to buy out her husband's debt to do so. Having had the house for 7 years, she said, we owed more than we had paid. I took on $275,000 or so of debt. As it turns out, the booming county Amy worked for was the home of the city whose fortunes had risen with the rise of the financial sector in the 1990s and 2000s, nicknamed Banktown. Charlotte, North Carolina, was the headquarters for large national banks that were growing by leaps and bounds in the lead-up to the crisis, including Bank of America and Wachovia. But the year after her divorce became final, all the construction of houses and office towers ground to a halt. The city began to cut back. By 2009, government employees like Amy were feeling it hard. The first thing they did was reduce our benefits and take away our holidays and put us on furlough without pay. Then they gave us pay cuts. Then, after amputating us one limb at a time, I got fired. She was able to get COBRA to extend her health care, but the monthly cost soared from a subsidized $80 to $779. Her mortgage payment on a conventional 30-year mortgage stayed at $1,200 a month, manageable but just barely based on unemployment insurance, alimony, and the little bits of income she could pull together through freelance jobs. As part of its belt tightening, the local government reassessed properties and revalued Amy's $255,000 house at $414,000, which almost tripled her property taxes. 6 months after she was laid off, Amy realized she wasn't going to be able to manage both her mortgage and her increased property taxes. Things were starting to snowball, she said. She called the owner of her mortgage, Wells Fargo, and told them that although she had not yet been late with a payment, her financial situation had changed and she wanted to sign up for one of the programs it offered to reduce borrowers' mortgage payments. Then they started putting me through the ringer, Amy said. Although she had no credit problems, Wells Fargo told her she needed to attend credit counseling. Okay, fine, I go, Amy said. I went to the Save Your Housing Fair. I went to the Housing Finance Agency. I went and did every single thing that there was out there to do. Wells Fargo had me jumping through hoops for 3 years. The Obama administration had started a number of programs, she recalled, to enable people to extend the term of their mortgage or, in some cases, reduce the interest rate or even the principal. I went for everything, Amy said. And everywhere I went, they blocked me and said, you can't apply for this program if you're under consideration for that. You can't apply for that while you're under consideration for this. Oh, that program is over. And it went around and around for months and months and months. The minute you go and you ask for help, even if you're not late making your payments, your credit score drops 100 points. So what that meant was that my Exxon card that I'd had since 1984, which had $600 or $700 on it for oil changes and tires, all of a sudden they jack up the interest rate to 35%. I've never been late, but I'm now a high-risk borrower. My unemployment's running out, and I'm selling jewelry to make the mortgage payments, and I realize they're going to take the house anyway. Amy put her home up for sale. I owed altogether $275,000, and we brought them offers within $10,000 of that, and Wells Fargo turned every one of them down. The bank would not accept a sale price any less than the full amount owed, nor would they take possession of the house instead of foreclosing on it. I did everything I could to avoid foreclosure, said Amy, knowing what that would do to my credit and my employability,
So at this point, I'm 55 years old, I'm doing piecemeal work everywhere and paying self-employment tax and COBRA and just going down in flames.
In 2013, Wells Fargo finally foreclosed on Amy Rogers. She was one of 679,923 Americans to experience foreclosure that year. But the shocks didn't end there. When her house went up for auction, Wells Fargo bought it from itself for $304,000. Why such a high price for a house that was selling for $275,000?
Because every time they sent me a letter from a lawyer or made a phone call, they billed me, Amy said. They wanted to recoup all their costs to foreclose on me.
As the final step in the foreclosure process,
the sheriff in his big hat and his big car drives up to your house in broad damn daylight, comes and knocks on your door and serves you with an eviction notice, said Amy. That is a dark day.
She sold or gave away most of her belongings and moved into a small rental condo where she lived until she had to move again in 2017. When Amy shared these details a year later, she said the rent on her new place was affordable, but the rundown neighborhood was gentrifying, so she feared the landlord would soon raise the rent.
I pay over $10,000 a year in rent, she said. I earn about $24,000.
When they foreclosed on me for the house, said Amy, they got everything. I got zero. They ruined my credit, and they ruined my employability because any employer you go to work for now does a credit check on you. I couldn't get a job for $10 an hour in Costco. I tried.
I paid into that house for 13 years. I've worked every day of my life since I'm 17 years old. And now, today, I'm 63 years old. I'm unemployable. I work 3 part-time jobs, and I'm praying I can last long enough to get Medicare so I'll have some health coverage.
Every part of Amy's story was one that I knew well from my research and advocacy at Demos, from the jacked-up credit card rate to the insufficient foreclosure prevention programs. I lobbied staff at the U.S. Treasury Department to improve them, to the job discrimination against people with weak credit. We wrote a bill banning the practice. Not a single part of her story surprised me, but it moved me still. I was grateful that she'd been willing to share her story with me, knowing it would be made public. There's so much shame involved in being in debt. In my experience with the bankers on the other end, however, shame is hard to find, even over their discriminatory and deceptive practices. Amy sighed.
I've kept it under wraps for 10 years, she said, too afraid of the way the world would perceive me.
If I could leave anybody who's gone through this with one message, she said, it is this. Do not say, I lost my house. You did not lose your house. It was taken away from you. The people who took Amy's house could do so with impunity in 2013, only because they had been doing it to homeowners of color for over a decade already, and had built the practices, corporate cultures, and legal and regulatory loopholes to enable that plunder back when few people cared. Subprime mortgages and the attitude of lender irresponsibility they fomented would, we now know, later spread throughout the housing market. But to truly understand where the crisis began, we have to go back earlier than the 1990s, to the reason it was so easy for lenders to target homeowners of color in the first place. The exclusion of free people of color from the mainstream American economy began as soon as Black people emerged from slavery after the Civil War. Black people were essentially prohibited from using white financial institutions, so Congress created a separate and thoroughly unequal Freedmen's Bank, managed and ultimately mismanaged into failure by white trustees. In the century that followed, the pattern of legally enforced exclusion continued in every segment of society, from finance to education to employment to housing. In fact, the New Deal era of the early 1930s, a period of tremendous expansion of government action to help Americans achieve financial security, was also a period in which the federal government cemented residential segregation through both practice and regulation. We think of the New Deal and all the great things that came out of it, and there were many,
But what we don't talk about nearly as often is the extent to which those great things were structured in ways that made sure people of color didn't have access to them, said Debbie Goldberg, a vice president of the National Fair Housing Alliance. I worked closely with the advocates at NFHA back in the early 2000s. Debbie is an advocate who spends her days fighting the latest attempts to roll back commitments to fair housing, and she has an encyclopedic knowledge of the history of American home ownership and the housing policies that had paved the way for the subprime mortgage crisis. In 1933, during the Great Depression, the U.S. government created the Homeowners Loan Corporation. Debbie explained, "Its role was to buy up mortgages that were in foreclosure and refinance them and put people back on their feet. It did a huge amount of that activity, billions of dollars worth, within a short period of time in the 30s. Perhaps this agency's most lasting contribution was the creation of residential security maps, which used different colors to designate the level of supposed investment risk in individual neighborhoods. A primary criterion for defining a neighborhood's risk was the race of its residents, with people of color considered the riskiest. These neighborhoods were identified by red shading to warn lenders not to invest there, the birth of redlining. A typical assessment reads, "The neighborhood is graded D because of its concentration of Negroes, but the section may improve to a third-class area as this element is forced out." The redlining maps were subsequently used by the Federal Housing Administration, created in 1934. In its early years, Goldberg explained, the FHA subsidized the purchase of housing in a way that made it very easy for working-class white people who had previously been renters and may never have had any expectation of becoming a homeowner to move to the suburbs and become a homeowner because it was often cheaper than renting. Both the structure and the interest rate of the mortgage made it possible for people to do that with very little savings and relatively low income. But the FHA would not make or guarantee mortgages for borrowers of color, she said. It would guarantee mortgages for developers who were building subdivisions, but only on the condition that they include deed restrictions preventing any of those homes from being sold to people of color. Here we have this structure that facilitated white home ownership and therefore the creation of white wealth at a heretofore unprecedented scale, and that explicitly prevented people of color from having those same benefits. To a very large degree, this was the genesis of the incredible racial wealth gap we have today. In 2016, the most recent available authoritative data, the typical white family in America had about $171,000 in wealth, mostly from homeownership. That's about 10 times that of Black families, at $17,600, and 8 times that of Latinx families, at $20,700. That kind of wealth is self-perpetuating. I thought of Amy, who on a modest income had still been able to afford a house with a low monthly payment, largely because of $50,000 from her parents. Learning this history was crucial to me in my early days at Demos. In order to help craft new laws to change the world we inhabited, I needed to understand how government decisions had shaped it. I underwent a steady process of unlearning some of the myths about the progressive victories like the New Deal and the GI Bill, achievements that I understood to have built the great American middle class. The government agencies most responsible for the vast increase in home ownership, from about 40% of Americans in 1920 to about 62% in 1960, were also responsible for the exclusion of people of color from this life-changing economic opportunity. Of all the African Americans in the United States during the decades between 1930 and 1960, fewer than 2% were able to get a home loan from the Veterans Administration or the Federal Housing Authority. The civil rights movement brought changes to housing laws, but lending practices changed more slowly. For instance, although the Fair Housing Act of 1968 outlawed racially discriminatory practices by banks, it would take another 24 years for the Federal Reserve System, the central bank of the United States, to monitor and, spottily, enforce the law. It is little wonder, then, that a fringe lending market flourished to offer credit and reap profits from people of color who were excluded from the mainstream financial system. These included rent-to-own contracts for household appliances and furniture,
and houses bought on contract. These contracts enabled Black people to buy on the installment plan and lose everything if they missed a single payment. Unlike a conventional mortgage, land contracts did not allow buyers to build equity. Indeed, they owned nothing until the final payment was made. And because the loans were unregulated, peddlers of these early forms of subprime mortgages could charge whatever exorbitant rates they chose. My great-grandmother bought the apartment building where I was born on a predatory contract. In the 1970s, residents of redlined neighborhoods, including actually some white working class, as well as African-American and Latinx activists, banded together to demand access to credit and economic investment in their communities. These local groups were backed and coordinated by community organizing networks such as the Chicago-based National People's Action and by national organizations that ranged from the National Urban League to the Catholic Church. As a result of this activism, Congress passed reforms to the discriminatory lending market in the 1970s, finally giving residents tools to combat redlining. One reform was the 1975 Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, or HMDA, which required financial institutions to make public the number and size of mortgages and home loans they made in each zip code or census tract, so that patterns of discrimination could be easily identified. Another was the 1977 Community Reinvestment Act, or CRA, which required financial institutions to make investments in any community from which they received deposits. For example, a 1974 survey of federally insured Chicago-area banks revealed that in several communities of color, for each dollar residents deposited in local banks, the community received only one penny in loans. The CRA enabled community and civil rights groups to monitor whether banks were fulfilling their obligations and to challenge the banks when they fell short. In 1978, two of the earliest formal complaints against banks that failed to meet their CRA obligations resulted in a total of more than $20 million in home loans for low-income residents of Brooklyn, as well as the St. Louis area, where financial institutions admitted they had been making loans in only one neighborhood, a neighborhood that was all white. But 1978 also saw an ominous sign of a coming wave of deregulation when a Supreme Court decision interpreted the National Bank Act to mean if a lender was in one of the few states without any limits on interest rates, it could lend without limits nationwide, effectively invalidating 37 states' consumer protections. And Congress declined to amend the law. That's why today most of your credit card statements come from South Dakota and Delaware, states with lax lending laws. By the mid-1990s, the financial sector had become the component of the economy that produced the most profits, supplanting manufacturing. The financial sector also became the biggest spender in politics, contributing more than $100 million per election cycle since 1990 to federal candidates and political parties on both sides of the aisle, translating unprecedented profits into unprecedented influence, netted the industry carte blanche with legislators and regulators, who were often eyeing lucrative jobs as lobbyists or banking consultants after their tours of duty in government service. The deregulatory revolution in financial services was also spurred by anti-government, pro-market libertarian and neoliberal economic thinking that gained a popular common sense, particularly among white people, with rising distrust of an activist government. By the end of the 1990s, a bipartisan majority voted to repeal most of Glass-Steagall, the law that had protected consumer deposits from risky investing for decades since the Great Depression. Free of restraints, the financial sector grew wildly and with few rules. This growth included an explosion of mortgage brokers and non-bank holding companies like those that pursued the Tomlins, many of which were not subject to the CRA and were unregulated and unaccountable to anything but the bottom line. Most important, there was no single regulator whose primary responsibility was to protect consumers. The four federal banking regulators' primary purpose was to ensure that banks were doing well, which put the profit machine of subprime directly at odds with the regulators' secondary consumer protection responsibilities. The upshot for the lending market was the unchecked growth of loans and financial products that were predatory in nature, meaning they benefited the lender even when they often created a net negative financial situation for the borrower, imposed harsh credit terms out of proportion to the risk the lender took on, and used deception to hide the reality of the credit terms from the borrower. And this formula was tried and tested on Black homeowners.